All right, welcome back. I am your host, Jimmy Church. When we come back, the one and only Graham Hancock. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. It is live to my left. And any questions or comments for myself or Graham during the show, you can do that live in real time. Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about not only humanity's history, but prehistory, and offers an increasingly popular challenge to the entrenched views of orthodox scholars. Now, his first book, Fingerprints of the Gods, literally changed things, and it's rare that that happens. He graduated from Durham University with the first class honors in sociology, and then he went on to pursue a career in quality journalism and writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. But then there was Fingerprints, and here we are now, 21 years later, and he's changing the world once again with Magicians of the Gods. And I would like to welcome back to Coast our good friend, Graham Hancock. Graham, good evening. Good morning, sir.
Hi, Jimmy. Good to be with you. Yeah, my morning, your evening.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. And Graham, I want to just start off and actually start off rather quickly and say this. About a year ago, you and I were talking, and you had said to me then, you said, Jimmy, I have never worked this hard on a book in my life. And I know you remember that conversation. Now it's done, and here we go. Are you happy?
Yes, I'm happy. I feel that I've done my job. I conscientiously worked to bring all the latest research that has a bearing on the lost civilization mystery, to bring it together in Magicians of the Gods, and to make that a fitting sequel to, obviously, Fingerprints of the Gods is my best known book, and Magicians of the Gods is the sequel to that book. It's taking the quest for the lost civilization much, much further, and taking account of very recent, very solid, rather worrying scientific evidence, which sheds a very different light on the prehistory of mankind.
And Fingerprints, you know, that's a pretty high goal, right? Because that it did. It changed the world. And so the expectations are really high.
It caught the moment.
Right.
You know, this was there's an element of luck in any author's life, and I think my timing with that book was lucky. It caught the moment. There was great fascination and interest in the mysteries of our past at that time in 1995 when Fingerprints of the Gods was published. And yeah, the success of the book took me by surprise, but it opened up many doors to me and enabled me to really get out there and dig deep and you know, research this subject thoroughly, which I think is what is needed. If I have any problem with this area, it's that there are so many really not thought through theories out there which are not based on solid evidence, and we're up against a very, very powerful mainstream here. And if we're going to deal with that mainstream, if we are actually going to change the way our history is read, then we have to up our game. You know, we can't afford to have very slack, very sloppy research getting out there and passing off as something real.
Certainly the mainstream, Graham, is starting to freak out. They're starting to realize that not only authors like you, but researchers and the alternative researchers that are out there are starting to move that paradigm a little bit.
Yeah, the paradigm is definitely moving. And let's also recognize that also affects some in the mainstream. The mainstream is not monolithic. You know, there are many people who we can regard as mainstream scholars who are open-minded and who are troubled by the new evidence that is coming out. So I think we are at a moment of paradigm shift. We are in the middle of it, and whenever you're in the middle of something, it's very difficult to see the edges and see where it's actually going to go. But that sense that we're in a process of a complete overturn of everything we thought to be real is very, very strong at the moment.
About 3 years ago, you and I were talking about the significance of, we've talked about it many times since then, but the significance of Göbekli Tepe. And
yeah. This is one of the sites which is changing history. Yes, it's Göbekli Tepe, and it's in southeastern Turkey. And what we have here is a giant, incredibly sophisticated, megalithic site. I think all our listeners understand what I mean by megalithic. It just means big stones. In the case of the stone circles at Göbekli Tepe, you're looking at pillars that typically weigh 15 to 20 tons. Some of them weigh significantly more than that. They've been organized in a highly sophisticated way. The world's first perfectly aligned north-south structure is found at Göbekli Tepe, which tells us for sure that astronomers were at work. There are precise astronomical alignments to various of the circles. The whole site speaks of immense sophistication, but here's the problem. It's 7,000 years older than any other known megalithic site on Earth. And this cannot be explained. You know, when we have sites like Stonehenge, famous site like Stonehenge in England, which is astronomically aligned, which is very precise, what is not perhaps realized is that Göbekli Tepe, both the excavated and the unexcavated areas, are about 50 times larger than Stonehenge and 7,000 years older than Stonehenge. And in the case of Stonehenge, you have a background. You have a settled agricultural population. You have surpluses being generated that allow specialists to emerge who can cut stone and do the astronomy and so on and so forth. But in Göbekli Tepe, the evidence shows that prior to the construction of that gigantic series of stone circles, there were just hunter-gatherers there. No settled agriculture, no opportunity for specialists to emerge. So it's a real anomaly that a site as huge and sophisticated as this appears 7,000 years before Stonehenge, with all the sophistication of Stonehenge, and none of the background. It just seems to pop out of nowhere. And the way that I explain that is that we're looking at a transfer of technology from the survivors of a lost civilization. The right. native foundation of Göbekli Tepe is 11,600 years ago, and that coincides with a gigantic global cataclysm.
Right.
This looks to me like the work of survivors. They already knew how to create megalithic architecture, and they understood agriculture, because that's also the moment when agriculture suddenly appears in the same region.
And you can't build a site like that without the support system that goes along with it. And quite honestly, none of that was supposed to exist.
And centuries of learning.
Right.
You see, what we don't see is the practice phase at Göbekli Tepe. As a matter of fact, the oldest stuff at Göbekli Tepe is the best. It kind of deteriorates over the next 1,000 years, and then they bury it, you know, completely bury it, cover it in rubble and rocks, and fill up all the stone circles and cover them up over the top, and then go further and put a hill over the top of it, an artificial hill. That's actually what Göbekli Tepe means in the Turkish language. It means pot-bellied hill. And that's what it was thought to be for the next 10,000 years or so, until the German Archaeological Institute stumbled across it in the mid-1990s and began the excavations that have created a huge headache for mainstream archaeology.
You've managed to, and I find this fascinating, Graham, the 10,500 BC date is something that I think now is established, and then we have 11,600, and then now we're put... Let me add the third date, which is 12,800 years now for magicians. And these are three significant dates that are now established in a global sense on multiple continents.
Yeah. Well, let me put the 10,500 BC date into context. 10,500 BC is give or take 12,500 years ago. Okay, and that was the date that I always focused upon in Fingerprints of the Gods as the moment of a tremendous global cataclysm. What I've done in Magicians of the Gods is take that analysis much, much further, using the very latest science, because we have very significant new scientific developments in this area. And we now know that there was, in fact, a cataclysmic episode, not just an instant, but a cataclysmic epoch, which lasted from 12,800 years ago until 11,600 years ago. And you have two spikes of cataclysm, one at 12,800 years ago, when the first fragments of a giant comet that had entered the solar system strike the Earth, and again 11,600 years ago, when further fragments of the same comet hit the Earth and cause massive flooding. And that date, 11,600 years ago, is the date, of course, that Plato gives us for the submergence and destruction of the lost civilization of Atlantis. So I think there are a lot of dots to join up here. And my understanding now is that we're looking at an episode of 1,200 years from 12,800 to 11,600 years ago when the Earth changed completely.
With Göbekli Tepe being deliberately buried, and again, that's been firmly established here, and that's a it's a frightening thought. And was there any forethought or vision or knowledge of some coming event where they needed to deliberately bury it? What's your idea behind that?
You know, it's impossible to know why it was deliberately buried, but it was not deliberately buried with the intention of destroying it. It was deliberately buried with the intention of preserving it. This was not something that was done by people who, for example, by invaders who hated Göbekli Tepe. The place was not smashed up. It was frozen in time. It was deliberately preserved, intact in the form that it found itself then. And that, to me, I'm guessing, of course, but it looks like a time capsule. It looks like something that was intended to be discovered in the future, lest mankind should forget, lest we should become a species with amnesia and not remember our past. An archive of knowledge was hidden at Göbekli Tepe, which, if we can decode it, I don't think it's the only place, by the way. Giza in Egypt is another. Places in Indonesia, too. All around the world are dotted time capsules that we are meant to find. And we are finding them now.
And for researchers like you, let's be, you know, very precise in what we're saying, so we could accurately look at, because it, like you said, there's no destruction there. And the detail and the level of what is at Göbekli Tepe, it's stunning. And we, you know, we're so thankful that it was deliberately buried, so we have something to research.
Absolutely. And bear in mind, Jimmy, that there are other sites. I visited another site called Karahan Tepe, which is about 50 miles from Göbekli Tepe. And there, sticking out of the ground in a farmer's field, basically, are the tops of more of these extraordinary T-shaped megalithic pillars. We just don't know how much is still under the ground in Turkey and in that region, because, you know, this is between the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. This is at the source of the civilization that in historical times became ancient Sumer. Recently, a researcher called Madeleine Daines has found in the cuneiform digital archive a piece of cuneiform tablet which actually shows an enclosure like Göbekli Tepe. And that tablet is dated to 3,500 BC. And that raises in my mind the question, were there other stone circles like Göbekli Tepe still functioning in historical times so that they could be depicted and recorded on this stone tablet? There's a real mystery, a kind of undercurrent in the past of humanity that is coming to the surface here.
With Stone Age man and how that complicates Giza and the construction of the pyramids and the intelligence of what was going on there, that's one thing for us to, that's one pill to swallow. But we back up 7,000 years and we go to Göbekli Tepe, truly something that shouldn't exist according to Orthodox academia. And then,
right.
Yeah, and you look at those pillars, and one of the key things there for me, Graham, besides the 3D, cat or whatever that is the belt buckle and the belt.
Yeah.
And that is high fashion. It's high intelligence and technology. What does that tell you about the intelligence of the people that were constructing it to begin with?
Well, one of the most intriguing things about the belts that the figures wear, because of course these pillars, as we call them at Göbekli Tepe, these T-shaped 15 or 20 ton pillars, are anthropoid. They represent human beings. They have arms crooked at the elbows, carved in high relief into the sides, and those arms then meet in the hands in front of the belly, just beside the belt. And on the belt, you see inscribed a letter that we today would recognize as the letter H. It looks like a letter in our own alphabet, the letter H. I'm not claiming that that's what it is, of course. But the funny thing is that that very same H symbol turns up at Tiwanaku in Bolivia on the other side of the world. And Tiwanaku is another site where we have, you know, serious question marks over the age of the site, and the way that the figures place their hands over their bellies with these long fingers that sort of almost touch in front of the belly, that's identical to the iconography of the Easter Island statues. So again, there's a sense that something is going on beneath the surface here, that we are going to have to come to terms with a complete readjustment of our understanding of our own past. It isn't simply a matter of primitive cavemen gradually evolving agriculture, building the first cities, and onwards through the Middle Ages to, you know, incredible smart technological us. That's not the story at all. We're the result of a reinvention of civilization, not of the slow, gradual development of civilization. We've lost something hugely important from our own record.
How do you think Urfaman plays into this as well?
Well, Urfaman is it's an intriguing figure. Unfortunately, we don't have you can't really pin down the date on it exactly because of the way that it was excavated. But this is a fully three-dimensional statue of a human being. You can now see it in the Şanlıurfa Museum in Turkey. And again, it has the hand position that is identical to the position of the pillars in the Göbekli Tepe stone circles. And judging from the excavation reports, Urfaman would appear to be about the same age, about 11 or 11 and a half thousand years old, which, if that's the case, would make it the earliest fully three-dimensional in the round sculpture of a human being. There's just a mass of material here that we need to get into. And then there's the whole question of the underground cities in Turkey, which some will have heard of. People like places like Derinkuyu, a new one's been discovered just recently. These are giant constructions carved out under the ground, going down in some cases 200 feet beneath the ground in multiple stories. And, you know, there are theories about what they are, but because they're cut out of solid stone and can't be accurately dated, you can only date them by associated organic material, which might have been brought in later. We really don't know how old they are. So mystery upon mystery, Jimmy.
I don't. One thing that I find fascinating, Graham, and I know you're putting together the same puzzles that I am, it seems like the knowledge was trickling from the north and heading south.
Oh, I don't strongly get that impression at all. I think there's also a strong southward orientation in all of this.
And pushing north, okay.
And pushing north. We are dealing with a globally distributed lost civilization, which was maritime in nature, which was present in several different parts of the globe. But we're talking the Ice Age here. You know, the period before 21,000 years ago is the buildup of the Ice Age, and the Ice Age reaches the last glacial maximum 21,000 years ago. And then you have this cataclysmic meltdown between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. It was the Ice Age, much of the Northern Hemisphere was completely uninhabitable. I mean, you did have tribes of hunter-gatherers in Northern Europe.
Well, let me jump in right there, Graham. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I want to talk about the impacts of the comets around the world and how you've put together that evidence. I find it absolutely fascinating. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight, the one and only Graham Hancock. We'll be right back. Our guest tonight, Graham Hancock. We're talking about his latest release, of course, Magicians of the Gods. And when we come back, we're going to ask Graham about the evidence of the comet destruction and that cataclysmic event that happened at 12,800 BC. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight, Graham Hancock. And Graham, right before the break, I said 12,800 BC. I think I misspoke. Can you straighten that out for me?
Yeah, thank you, Jimmy, for remembering that. I was going to say that. Yeah, it's 10,800 BC, 12,800 years ago. Obviously, with such distant dates, there's a margin of error. You have to allow a sort of 100 years leeway either way with the data. You can't resolve the data closer than that. But the key dates are 10,800 BC, 12,800 years ago, and 11,600 years ago, which is 9,600 BC. We have two spikes of cataclysm then. And this is not just me talking. What I'm doing in Magicians of the Gods is reporting in layman's language the discoveries of a group of more than 30 scientists who've been publishing their data in journals like the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the Journal of Geology, the Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, and so on and so forth. Very rarefied data, which by and large, except for a few headlines, has not reached the general public. And so I've made it my job in Magicians of the Gods to put that new science together in a solid way that's readable and accessible so that the public can be aware of what's going on, because this is a really revolution in our understanding of the past. It used to be thought that the last true extinction level event on this planet was 66 million years ago, when a giant asteroid, we now believe it was a comet, by the way, hit the Earth and caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. Nobody imagined that there had been another extinction level event much more recently than that. And NASA was working with estimates of 100 million years between extinction level events. But what's come out in the last decade is that an extinction level event, very much on the scale of the extinction of the dinosaurs, occurred in that window between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. Global extinctions. This is when the mammoths went down across Siberia and in North America. Global extinctions took place at that time. And obviously, scientists were curious as to what caused this. Then they discovered that exactly at that time, there had been a sudden drop in global temperatures. 12,800 years ago, the world was beginning to warm up, was coming out of the ice age, and then suddenly you have this massive deep freeze, which takes the world back into the coldest temperatures ever experienced during the ice age. And this lasts for 1,200 years. It's accompanied at the beginning by global flooding. And then at the end, 11,600 years ago, the mystery is that global temperatures suddenly shoot up, making any notion of global warming today look ridiculous. They suddenly shoot up on a dramatic scale. There's more enormous flooding. And that's the moment we've been taught up till now when the first steps towards the beginnings of civilization are seen. And my whole argument is that what we're looking at is not the first steps. We're looking at an attempt to restart civilization after this giant global cataclysm. Now, I don't want to just talk wall to wall, but I would like to say a little bit more about the comet and what the scientists have worked out now.
Yeah, and I'm going to go exactly right there. And leading into that, is this the comet event? Could this be what stopped the woolly mammoth in their tracks when they were eating green grass and then were suddenly dead?
Yes. In a one-word answer, this is the key to the cataclysm. We all knew that something cataclysmic happened at that time.
Right.
But the new science tells us exactly what it was. And here's basically what the scientists have reconstructed. There are such things as giant comets, and they come from an area very distant in space that astronomers refer to as the Oort cloud. It's a kind of sphere containing trillions of comets on the outer edges of the solar system. And this Oort cloud is affected by the motions of the solar system in orbit around the galaxy. And in those motions, it encounters areas of resistance that destabilize the Oort cloud and send comets winging in towards the inner solar system. And these comets can be as much as 100 miles in diameter. They travel very fast at around 70,000 miles an hour. And they come into the inner solar system on an elliptical orbit. And if that orbit crosses the orbit of the Earth, we have a problem. And it turns out that one of those comets entered the inner solar system about 20,000 years ago. For the next 7,000 and a few hundred years, it was okay. The Earth missed it. But as comets everywhere always do, this comet began to break up into fragments. Many of our listeners will remember Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, which hit Jupiter in 1994 and broke up into 21 lethal glowing fragments.
Dramatic.
It appears that
yes.
The same thing happened to this giant comet that entered an Earth-crossing orbit. It began to fragment. Those fragments spread out along the whole path of its orbit. That path is 30 million kilometers wide. We still pass through it twice a year. It's called the Taurid Meteor Stream. 12,800 years ago, some big bits dropped out of it and hit the Earth. 11,600 years ago, some more big bits dropped out of it and hit the Earth. They accounted for the two spikes of the cataclysm and the events that took place in between. There's evidence that we've been hit by further fragments of that comet during the Bronze Age. The last time we were hit by a bit of it was in 1908. It was the so-called Tunguska incident, fortunately, over an uninhabited area of Siberia. It destroyed 80 million trees across more than 2,000 square kilometers, which is about the size of the city of London.
Right.
That was the last object that has come down out of the Taurid Meteor Stream. And the astronomers, this is very mainstream astronomers, not conspiracy theorists, are worried that the Taurid Meteor Stream still contains several fragments, large ones, of the original comet, and that we should be paying attention to it. And it may be that part of what Göbekli Tepe is a message from the past to the future, urging us to pay attention to the skies, perhaps to take our minds off the habit of mutual hatred and fear and destruction which is so ingrained in the world today, and work together on a grand project to ensure a future for our children and our children's children. That ultimately is the message of the stones.
You actually went on location up in Northwest America to look at the evidence. What did you find when you went there?
The Pacific Northwest of the United States, beautiful, dramatic, amazing landscapes, which bear the fingerprints, the marks of the cataclysm that was caused by the first group of comet impacts 12,800 years ago, because the epicenter of those impacts was on the North American ice cap. Remember, this was the Ice Age. 12,800 years ago, there was still ice, the best part of 2 miles deep, covering much of North America. The calculations of the scientists are that at least four large fragments of the comet hit the North American ice cap, producing explosive power that would dwarf the entire nuclear arsenal of the Earth going off at once. Massive kinetic energy and heat, liquidizing large areas of the ice cap and causing dramatic, tumultuous flooding running south into the states that we now call Oregon and Washington. And that flooding is evident on the ground. Now, until recently, scientists have explained that flooding by the outburst of glacial lakes, and many people will have heard of the story of Glacial Lake Missoula and
right.
so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But what we're now finding is that that was only part of the picture. Those glacial lakes were themselves filled up and forced to burst their banks by the melting of the ice cap caused by the comet impacts. And you can see the evidence on the ground. You can see giant boulders, they're called glacial erratics, which were carried on the flood in icebergs the size of oil tankers and enchained inside those oil tanker-sized icebergs were huge rocks, sometimes weighing as much as 20,000 tons. And you can see these rocks, which don't come from that area, scattered all across the Pacific Northwest. You can see huge ripples in the ground, 50 feet high and hundreds of feet long, for example, in the Camas Prairie, which speak again of the ebb of these huge floods. The evidence is writ large on the ground, and I had the privilege of doing that research journey with a great catastrophist researcher, Randall Carlson, really opened my eyes to the devastation that was left on the Earth at that time.
What about other locations? Because it broke off into multiple fragments. What about the evidence that was on the east coast of the United States? Did you guys venture over there too?
There are a number of suspect craters in the northeast of the United States, particularly in Canada, for example, the Corusol crater and the Bloody Creek structure,
right,
which look very much to be impact craters caused by further fragments of the comet. The comet went on across the Atlantic Ocean. There were further impacts on the northern European ice cap. And the furthest east that the scientists have traced the comet impacts is Syria, at a site called Abu Huraira, within about 100 miles of Göbekli Tepe.
That's frightening. Did you make it there?
No, I've not been into Syria at all. It's a difficult country to research, and I'm quite happy to keep my head on my shoulders.
Yeah, right. Well, we also have the same problem with Göbekli Tepe now, too. It is not exactly distant from the border. It's right on the border.
Unfortunately, Jimmy, you're right. Southeastern Turkey has become very unstable. That feeling was not in the air when I made my research trips there, but things have got a lot worse. I think it's safe enough to go to Göbekli Tepe. I'm not offering any guarantees. I'm certainly going to be going back there. I think the Turks have got the security situation in their country reasonably under control, but tragically, the whole area is unstable, unpredictable, and you just can't say what is going to go on.
I need to ask you quite directly, actually, with the critics and everything from Fingerprints and what you've been doing over the years and rolling that rock uphill. You and I have discussed this enough for a while now. How has the reaction from that same negative group been for magicians? Are you starting to turn the tide? Are you starting to change minds? Or are they just going to do what they're going to do?
No, I mean, the haters are going to hate, you know, whatever happens. And there's nothing we can do about that. All any of us in this field can do is speak our truth and hope that some progress is made. But I do see a growing openness of mind amongst some mainstream academics. I mean, for example, when I was investigating Baalbek in the Lebanon, an extraordinary megalithic site that I report extensively in Magicians of the Gods, I found myself in some interesting dialogue, profound disagreement, but nonetheless interesting dialogue with a German archaeologist and architect there, which I found very useful. And, you know, the encouraging thing is that they weren't simply dismissing me as some kind of lunatic fringe. They were realizing that there was a problem and that they needed to engage with that problem. And I hope in that process that we can more constructively engage with the mainstream in the future, because the mainstream does have a lot to offer. And neither I nor any of my colleagues in this field could really do our work without the meticulous groundwork done by mainstream scholars. So really, we would like cooperation rather than conflict. We would like to put our heads together and rediscuss the whole mysterious part of humanity.
Why do you think it is, Graham, that something as significant as Göbekli Tepe, with the origins of man and lost civilizations and knowledge and where we actually were and came from, could be the biggest breaking news of the century, or maybe of all time, but it has not been discussed in mainstream news when it should be a headline somewhere? Well, why is that?
Exactly, because the mainstream news has another agenda. The mainstream news just wants to fill us all with fear so that we are divided from one another, wants to multiply hatreds. And above all else, the mainstream media want us to go on being good producers and consumers who don't really ask any questions. Because the moment we start to ask questions about the past, isn't it obvious, we're also asking questions about the present. And that's very threatening to those who hold the reins of power today. I think that's really the heart of the problem.
And I want to stay and go Göbekli Tepe for a second. The thought of it being deliberately buried, too, as well, for us, and the carbon dating's been verified. And then I have seen
a
shift.
Can I just add on that, a very important point, that it is the deliberate burial of Göbekli Tepe that allows us to be sure of the date.
And which is my question. Now, you and I think so much alike, it's kind of funny. Because I have seen other research that has surfaced as of late that are saying now that the carbon dating could be only 6,000 BC, that it's not as old as we thought, and the numbers are way off. And why would they intentionally try to poo-poo, some very difficult research that's been going on for 20 years?
No, not at all. I mean, my source was Klaus Schmidt himself,
right?
The discoverer and excavator of Göbekli Tepe. And I spent 3 days going over that site in minute detail with Klaus Schmidt, enclosure by enclosure, and having him explain everything to me. This is the world owes the late, great Klaus Schmidt a debt of gratitude for his incredible work at Göbekli Tepe, for the discovery and the excavation of that site. His meticulous work done by the German Archaeological Institute, and they are absolutely certain of the dates of 9600 BC for the foundation, for the mysterious sudden foundation of that site.
How much is left to excavate? Right now, we know about 22.
By the way, I should mention, Klaus Schmidt passed away in 2014.
That's right.
And it's possible that other scholars may take over at Göbekli Tepe who don't like the message that Göbekli Tepe has for us. And it's possible that that could be hidden. Scholarship does have its dark side, but I'm not saying that's happening. I just know that I totally trusted Klaus Schmidt, but I don't know who's running the site now.
There's 22, 23 individual circles right now, and it's been reported that that's about 25% of the site. That it's huge.
Well, Klaus Schmidt told me that they went over the site with ground-penetrating radar, and that they've identified, 50 unexcavated stone circles with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of giant megalithic pillars still sitting there under the ground. So the story of Göbekli Tepe is by no means over. The question is, will that excavation continue, or is the site just going to be frozen into a kind of tourist attraction?
Are you there? All right, this is Coast to Coast AM. We've lost Graham. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. When we come back after the break, we're going to be joined with Daryl Sims, the alien hunter. Now, Daryl has just gotten back from India, and he's got some evidence with him. We're going to talk about that and another new case that he is working on that is absolutely groundbreaking. And yes, it does involve an assistant attorney general right here in the United States that has come forward with some implant information on them. This is Coast to Coast AM. I am your host, Jimmy Church. Follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. Twitter is live to my left.